Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Darren, good job. Thanks for getting the Archbishop of Portlandia on for the last hour. This hour...
Have you seen that show?
I think I saw one episode.
Okay.
It was one of those, hey, look at, you got to see this. Uh-huh. It might have just been a section of the episode.
Uh-huh.
It's weird.
It is. It's a comedy show for people don't know.
Yeah, it's a comedy show, but...
And like most comedy shows, it has some non-family-friendly material in it.
Oh, okay.
But it also has some really funny stuff.
Oh, okay.
I have not seen much of it, but I've seen some clips.
The impression I got of it is that the people who make the show think that Portland is made up of wacky people, like completely wacky people, which may be the case. Mm-hmm. I don't know. But
have you been there?
Not as an adult.
Okay.
No. So I have no real... Have you been there?
Yeah. Yeah.
Is it wacky people? Or you don't want to say?
Well, some.
Some.
But
okay.
Then some everywhere are wacky people.
That's true.
Some have referred to you and me that way. So
I can't imagine why, especially you, Jimmy, the man who does weird questions with Jimmy Akin and Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World.
Yeah.
Who would refer to you as wacky? I am excited about our hour together today. This is a topic I love.
Uh-huh.
And I love learning about it from you. You've spent a life... learning about it yourself, and there's always fascinating things. We're going to talk about what life was like in Jesus' day.
Yeah, I'm excited also because it will hopefully get La Donna Immobile out of my head.
You have that stuck in your head?
Yeah.
How does that happen?
Well, it's an earworm, or as known in English, older English, a maggot.
Okay, so how'd you get a maggot in your ear?
I thought about a scene in Star Trek Voyager where they're singing La Donna Immobile,
yeah.
And I've had it stuck in my head since.
All right, I gotta not think about that melody
from the opera Rigoletto.
Oh, I didn't know that where it came.
Yeah, that's where it's from. And la donna, woman or the lady, or just woman. Is mobile, mobile or fickle.
Oh, it's a fickle woman.
Fickle woman is fickle, or the lady is fickle. Yeah.
Yes, we don't believe that anymore.
It depends on the woman.
Mm-hmm. No. Yeah, I suppose it does.
Like some women are wacky, some women are fickle, some women are stable, some women are not wacky, you know?
Yeah. Okay. Fair enough. In this case, she was fickle. Our number is 888-318-7884. Jimmy Akin is senior apologist here at Catholic Answers, the author of many things, including this beautiful new book, The Bible is a Catholic Book. And you can get that at shop.catholic.com or wherever they sell good Catholic books. Because if they don't have it, they're missing out on at least one good Catholic book. But we're going to talk about the life of Jesus, the life of the people of Jesus' day. What was life like in those days?
This is something that is kind of a recent thing in terms of history. A lot of people have the idea that history involves, battles and kings and things like that.
Right.
And it does. But in recent years, there's also been a focus among historians on what's sometimes called the history of private life, how ordinary people lived. And so we're going to today, depending on what you ask me and what other people ask me, we can look at both of those, both how ordinary people lived, what life was like for them, and then also some of the major like geopolitical things that affected their lives.
Yeah. Okay. And it's a very democratic concern, really. I don't just want to know what the king was doing, but what was the regular guy doing? What was a regular person doing?
Very
in those
demotic
days?
Of you.
Demotic?
Yeah.
Now I got to look another word up. Demotic means?
Well, it's from demos, which is the people, from which we get democracy.
Oh.
Demos arche, the people rule. So democracy. But demotic is also just of the people.
Oh, nothing describes anybody like me. I am literally of the people.
Yeah.
Two of them, my mom and my dad.
Yeah.
So I don't like to share personal details like that, but I have two parents.
Well, most people do.
Oh, all right. Life in Jesus' day, 888-318-7884 is the number. So I am guessing not a lot of jobs in high tech. What were people doing?
Yeah.
How did people make money in Jesus' day?
So everybody before the industrial age was after the Neolithic. But before the industrial age, almost everybody was a farmer. That was by far the most common job. Agriculture was at a state of development where you could feed your family and some additional people, but the economy was dominantly agrarian, so lots of farmers. But there were other jobs that people had. There were, in addition to people who farmed, there were craftsmen, and we read about some of those in, for example, in the New Testament, like Joseph. Joseph was a builder. And so you had people who were craftsmen, who were builders, carpenters, what have you. You had metal workers. You know, you had smiths. You had physicians like Luke. There's another craft.
Yeah.
You also had officials of various types. You had all the way up to kings, you know, and emperors. But then people on lower levels of administration like tax collectors or tax farmers. They were sometimes called
tax farmers.
Yeah, because what they would do is the way taxation often worked in the Roman Empire was you would have local officials who were the tax collectors, but they didn't do it like modern tax collectors, where it's a fixed percentage of your income that you give and that just basically passes through the hands of the tax collector and he is paid a wage, a fixed wage.
Yeah.
The way tax farming worked was, and this is part of the reason why tax collectors were hated even more then than they are now, is tax farmers would squeeze the local populace for as much money as they could get and then give the share that was required of them to the higher ups, and they could keep the residue.
Mm. So they had tough guys with them?
Yeah, they would have tough guys and so forth.
Yeah.
And Matthew, we know, was a tax collector. Mm-hmm. Were part of his career. Also, Zacchaeus was a tax collector. So we read about them as well. And so we see a number of these other professions, even though most people were farmers or other kinds of agriculturalists, there were these other professions, including one that was very common among Jesus' disciples. Any guesses what that might have been?
I don't even have to guess. I already know.
What's that?
Fishermen.
Oh, I thought you were going to say computer programmer. But yes, fishermen.
I was thinking about it. But
uh-huh.
Yeah, so because he grew up near a big
the
lake.
Sea of Galilee. Yeah. It's also, you can translate it either way from Greek, the Sea of Galilee, the Lake of Galilee.
Mm-hmm.
It's also known as Lake Tiberias.
Like Tiberias.
That's because the city of Tiberias is built on its shores.
Oh, I just thought it was Tiberius naming stuff after himself.
Yeah.
He also would do that.
Mm-hmm.
People made a living by primarily agriculture.
Mm-hmm.
So that does give a kind of insight into a lot of Jesus's parables.
Yes.
They have a very agriculture. As a matter of fact, if you don't understand a little bit about agriculture, sometimes you can't really get what he's talking about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And him and John the Baptist. Like, for example, John the Baptist talks about how the one coming after him is going, his winnowing fork is in his hand, and he will separate the wheat and the chaff, and the wheat he'll gather into his barn, but the chaff he'll burn with unquenchable fire.
Right.
Most people today have no idea what that means.
Yeah, right. Winnowing, separating, how is all this, what's going on here?
So when wheat grows, it's a kind of grass, but it has this edible part of it. And over the centuries and millennia, we've bred it to yield more of the edible part. But there's still this unedible part that mm-hmm. we can't digest and that's nasty and so forth. And so what happens is when you harvest the wheat, you then thresh it. And this can be done different ways, but one of the classic ways is you have a millstone to mill it, and you have like an ox guiding the millstone around, and it crushes the wheat, and it separates the edible component from the inedible component, which is called the chaff. But then once you've separated it, you need to get rid of the chaff, and because the edible grain part is heavier than the chaff, what you do is you take a winnowing fork or shovel and you throw it up in the air. And if there's wind, and you can even make wind by using big fans. Not modern fans, but the kind you'd have like slaves wave up and down.
Right. Yeah.
Though, by the way, that was another popular job in the ancient world. A lot of people fan waiting guy? For being slaves.
Oh, yeah. Slaves. I yeah. thought you meant fanboy, fan guy.
yeah, okay. But you would throw the grain and the chaff up in the air, and the wind would carry the chaff away off the threshing floor, and then you would gather up the wheat, and you could eat the wheat, but then you needed to like sweep up the chaff and do something with it, like burn it.
I gotcha. Okay. Jimmy Akin is our guest. Jimmy Akin, of course, is senior apologist here at Catholic Answers, and we're talking about life in the time of Jesus. Your calls are welcome, 888-318-7884. We'll take a quick break and be right back with more on life in the time of Jesus.
We'll be right back with more Catholic Answers Live.
Hey, it's Wednesday, and that means a new episode of our podcast, Catholic Answers Focus, has dropped. You can check it out at CatholicAnswersFocus.com or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Catholic Answers Focus, the world's premier podcast on Catholic apologetics, now available every Wednesday at CatholicAnswersFocus.com.
The Aquinas Writing Advantage Program is part of Homeschool Connections' set of online courses for your Catholic homeschool. Homeschool Connections' website is homeschoolconnections.com.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects home buyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
Unplanned, the true story of Abby Johnson.
I would be the youngest director in Planned Parenthood history.
She believed in a woman's right to choose.
I've had an abortion myself, so I don't have any problem with another woman making the same decision.
Until the day she saw something that changed everything.
Tiny, perfect little baby. And then it was just gone.
Now she's pulling back the curtain on the abortion industry. Unplanned.
Available at EWTNRC.com and the EWTN app.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. We're talking about life in the time of Jesus. A great topic as we prepare to commemorate the coming of the Savior. What was the world like that he was born into? Our first caller, Patrick from New York City, who watches on Facebook Live. Patrick, I believe I know you. You were just at our conference. We've met several times.
Yeah, I was at the last conference, already signed up for the next one. I love going to them.
Did you get that on tape, Nick, so we can use that as a commercial? All right.
Yeah. Cool. At the time of Jesus, the Romans had occupied the Holy Land. The Romans hated the Jews, and the Jews hated the Romans. My question is, were the Romans especially cruel to the Jews in a way that would justify the Jews to revolt, or were the Romans just cruel to everybody, and there was no reason to be especially cruel to the Jews?
The Romans were... could be brutal to everybody, and they didn't have a special antipathy towards Jews in particular. Actually, there were some points of friction. So what would happen in the Roman Empire is they would take over a land, and if you want, Si, we can even talk about how they ended up taking over Judea.
Okay.
But they would take over a land and they would install a client king, and the client or a governor or something, and the client king or whatever other ruler they installed was supposed to govern the land and keep peace there, and also funnel various resources back to Rome as tribute, as well as in meeting certain strategic needs. Like one of the big problems that Rome had was feeding its population. And so they needed to keep the grain supplies coming from the east, in particular Egypt. If you're reading older books, they'll talk about the corn supply. And they don't mean corn in the modern sense of what we think of as corn. That's Indian corn.
Yeah.
You know, what your people called maize, if you remember the old commercials.
Oh, yeah, right.
but that's Indian corn that's native to the New World. When they said corn, they just meant grain.
Yeah.
And so you'd have like these big wheat fields in and so forth in the Nile Delta. And so one of the big concerns was making sure Egypt was stable and under Rome's control at this time to make sure that the corn factors or the grain makers, the grain merchants, could get grain to Rome to feed the populace. Also, is some locations like Israel were kind of strategic. They had strategic value for the Romans because they were sort of military routes and buffers between Rome and some non-Roman peoples that they sometimes went to war with in the east, like the Parthians, for example, who were in modern Iran. And so what the Romans wanted, they didn't want to just be cruel to people. They just wanted stability and resources to flow productively in the empire. And actually, a lot of people thought it was just great. They might think, okay, well, they could be a little nicer, but yeah, actually, they've provided peace and prosperity for us. There were benefits to being associated with the Romans. They protected their friends. Mm-hmm. In fact, in the time of the Maccabees, the Hasmonean rulers sought Roman help against against the Seleucid kings that were persecuting them.
About what, 200 years, 150?
About 150 BC or so.
Yeah.
And so they were happy to be friends of Rome at the time because there were benefits to being part of the Roman world. But there were also problems. You did have nationalist feelings that would arise in various locations, and that obviously happened in Israel, and that would lead to a crackdown. If you had an insurrection, the Romans would deal with it, and they would be cruel, but they weren't setting out to just be mean to everybody. Mm-hmm. But they would be ruthless when they felt it was necessary to deal with the problem. And insurrections was one of the big ones. They were also on the lookout for vassal kings who would betray them, and so forth. And they had a kind of complex relationship with Jewish people in terms of religion. Romans fancied themselves as being the most religious people around. They wanted to honor everybody. I mean, maybe you didn't want to be a member of a mystery cult, but as any established ancient faith, they wanted to honor it. And that one thing they recognized Jews as having was an ancient faith, because Moses predated by, depending on the reckoning you want to use, as much as 700 years, the founding of the city of Rome.
Yeah, so they respected the ancient nature of it.
They respected the ancient nature of Jewish religion. They let Jews practice their religion. There were sacrifices. The emperors supported the temple in Jerusalem. In fact, there were sacrifices offered every day for Augustus at the temple in Jerusalem. And they funded the temple in Jerusalem. They wanted the Jewish God to bless them, along with all the other gods they wanted to bless them. Uh-huh. And so they would be positive. Now, they didn't want to be Jews. They didn't want to keep kosher. They didn't want to be circumcised. But they wanted to respect this ancient faith, but they didn't want problems.
Yeah.
And sometimes you would have problems, including of a religious nature. So one of the most prominent Roman symbols, sometimes think animal symbols. What are some prominent Roman animal symbols you can think of?
The wolf.
Wolf, right, because yeah. Of the she-wolf that suckled Romulus and Remus. There's another one that would be on the banners of their armies.
Eagle.
The eagle, yeah. Right. So the eagle was a symbol of Rome. And to make nice with the Romans who supported the vassal king Herod the Great.
Okay.
He put a golden eagle in front of the temple.
Oh, that now, seems problematic.
Yeah, it seemed problematic to a number of his subjects.
Yeah.
And it led to one older gentleman getting a bunch of young hot-headed men to tear it down.
Yeah.
And so there was a famous incident where these guys tore down the eagle, which would have been taken as a slight to the Romans. And
it's like a Roman Pachamama,
sort of. Yeah, only it ended not very well for these gentlemen who tore it down.
Oh, yeah, right.
Because
you can imagine.
Herod didn't want his gesture to the Romans being perceived as a slight, his subjects slighting the Romans who were supporting his reign.
But they were trying to defend the holiness of the temple.
Yeah,
yeah,
exactly. So you had these kind of conflicts where there were even though Romans wanted to be respectful of Jewish religion, many people in who were Jews felt that there were lines that we cannot cross.
Yeah.
And that led to conflict.
Mm-hmm.
Also, people have an innate desire for autonomy. And in some places, that desire for autonomy is going to lead them to resist, and
right.
That's going to lead to conflict in some situations.
Our number, 888-318-7884. Patrick, thank you very, very much for that call. Really do appreciate that call. Let's go to another call. We got time to go to another caller. Let's go to Holly in Vallejo, California, also watching on Facebook Live. Holly, your question for Jimmy Akin.
Well, good afternoon, and thank you for taking my call. I've been wondering about, you know, in the last hour we talked a little bit about reverence, and I know I've heard Catholics talk about, they kind of lament the what they perceive as the loss of reverence in the Mass now as opposed to pre-Vatican II. And I understand that, but from my perspective coming into the church from a Protestant background, because I'm still in the RCIA program, mm-hmm. I love the reverence of the Mass. I mm-hmm. love the music and the kneeling, and it's all just, I mean, Protestant churches, I think, don't really even have reverence in some of those ways. So I'm kind of wondering, if we think about reverence and what that means, what was it like in the early time of Jesus? Like, what would it have looked like in the temple? What would it have looked like to be reverent as an early Christian?
Okay. So first of all, we want to say that, you know, there are Protestants who are quite reverent, and also Catholics who are not so reverent, including before Vatican II. I mean, you would hear sermons about how people should be more reverent than they were. So,
yeah.
it's a mix. In terms of how reverence was displayed in the time of Jesus, it would vary somewhat, you know, because different people back then had different cultures and different inclinations, just like we do today. But one of the things that was common for Jews to do when they prayed was to stand up. Today, we have various postures of prayer. We might pray kneeling. We might pray sitting. We might pray standing. We might, in some circumstances, even get on our face, you know, lie down on our face and pray. That's called prostration.
Yeah.
And you did have prostration occur in the ancient world, including in Jesus' day, as a form of reverence that you would give to another person. So like if you had a king, you might prostrate yourself before him, or a holy man. So people will come up and it'll say that he fell down before Jesus, and it means he prostrated himself.
Oh, okay.
But when it was very common for Jewish individuals to stand up when they were praying and to spread their arms, and this gives rise to what's sometimes called the orans position. Orans is Latin for praying. So okay. If you extend your arms as you're praying, that's called the orans position.
I see, yeah.
And it also makes your body look like a cross. And so this became popular with Christians because it physicalized the image of Jesus' death in the act of prayer. And so Christians in particular adopted the orans position. But it was also common in other situations. You would have, for example, St. Paul talking about how I want men everywhere to lift up holy hands in prayer.
Oh, and he's referring to that.
To that or some similar related posture.
Yeah.
You also, though, did have prayers occur kneeling. I don't know that this would have been done in the temple. The temple was extremely crowded. But it may have been. One of the things that is said about James the Just, the so-called brother of the Lord, he was sometimes, according to one early account that we have, this isn't a first century account, but it is an early account that may contain genuine historical elements, says he had knees like a camel because of how much time he spent praying. So he like had calloused knees that may have even been habituated further to a kneeling posture for prayer. So you would see that. You would also see in the temple, if you went to the temple, it was considered extremely beautiful. much more beautiful than most ancient temples. Josephus, the Jewish historian, contains descriptions of the tapestries that it had. They had designs on them in scarlet and purple and blue, really intense, colors for the tapestries. It was made out of white stone faced with white stone, overlaid with gold. You know, like we mentioned, the golden eagle. Right. Well, the temple furnishings were often gold. And the rabbis later had a saying, which was that if you have not seen Herod's temple, you have not seen a beautiful building. Because it was considered beautiful even for temples in the ancient world. And you would have gone there and seen lots of people, dozens and dozens of priests. In fact, there were an astonishing number of priests. We should probably talk about that on the other side of the break because
okay,
there's
Holly,
an interesting
hang on.
Story there.
Thank you very much for this wonderful question, Holly. We're talking about what life was like in the time of Jesus. Right back with more with Jimmy Akin, senior apologist here at Catholic Answers, right after this.
Hi, this is Father Robert Spitzer, president of the Majus Center of Reason and Faith, and you're listening to Catholic Answers Live.
Every Catholic has heard the challenge. How can you believe that? Don't you know the Bible says? It's a challenge we have to meet. If we can't reconcile apparent contradictions between Scripture and Catholic teaching, how can our faith survive? And if we can't answer our Protestant brothers and sisters, how will they ever come to embrace the fullness of the faith? In Meeting the Protestant Challenge, apologist Carlo Broussard gives you the knowledge and tools you need to answer 50 of the most common Bible-based objections to Catholicism. Be prepared to give an answer. Order your copy of Meeting the Protestant Challenge today by calling 844-239-4952, visiting shop.catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Many Catholics ignore the Bible. They say they have the Church instead. But we should embrace sacred Scripture, not just as the revealed Word of God, but as a Catholic work, intimately connected with the Church from the earliest centuries. In The Bible is a Catholic Book, apologist Jimmy Akin shows how the Bible cannot exist apart from the Church, in its origins, in the truths it contains, in its careful preservation over the centuries. Scripture is inseparable from the Catholic faith. This is fitting, since both come from God for our salvation. If you're a Catholic who sometimes gets intimidated by the Bible is a Catholic Book will help you better understand and take pride in this gift that God gave the world through the Church. After all, Catholics are the original Bible Christians. Order your copy of The Bible is a Catholic Book today by calling 1-844-239-4952, visiting shop.catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Tomorrow on More to Life, peace I leave with you.
Feeling anxious will help you increase your peace.
Now, back to Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host, Jimmy Akin, in studio with us today. Don't forget about Jimmy's wonderful new book, The Bible is a Catholic Book. It's available at shop.catholic.com, and it's also available in bulk right now. We'd love it if, for those of you who maybe you're a parish and you're thinking about what should we give folks who come to Mass on Christmas Day? Well, maybe you'd consider The Bible as a Catholic Book. It won't set you back too much if you buy it in bulk, and it's a real invitation to become closer to the Bible and to the Catholic faith. We were talking with Holly before we went to the break. Our topic this hour is what life was like in the time of Jesus. Holly asked a very interesting question about how people expressed reverence at the time, and you were talking about the
yeah,
temple.
Yeah, she asked in particular about what you would have seen at the temple, and it was very crowded. One of the things you would have seen there is lots of priests. Now, if you go back and you, say, read the Torah, you know, the first five books of the Bible, it talks about the institution of the Jewish priesthood, of Aaron and his sons, and they're supported by the tribe of Levi, who are not priests. But initially, we have the entire nation of Israel being ministered to by just this very small group, Aaron, the high priest, and his sons.
Yeah.
Well, by the time of Jesus, the population had grown substantially, including the line of Aaron. Mm-hmm. And there were thousands of priests in Israel at the time.
Okay.
I want to say my memory is that there were about 8,000. But what that meant is there were so many priests that they couldn't all serve at the temple simultaneously. And so what happened was they were divided into 24 groups known as courses, and each course would come to the temple for like a week, twice a year. And we see this, for example, in Luke's gospel. In the infancy narrative before Jesus is born, where Zechariah the priest goes up to the temple, and then he goes home to, to Elizabeth,
yes,
and John the Baptist is conceived. Mm-hmm. Well, that's because he was up for his rotation during his period at the temple, during one of his biannual visits to serve at the temple. Now, you can imagine if you only do your religious job twice a year.
Yeah, it's not going to pay the bills, is it?
Well, no, but also, how well are you going to remember all those ceremonies that you do at the temple?
Oh, what am I supposed to be doing again?
Exactly.
It's been 6 months since I was here.
And so what happened was, and also there's only a certain number of ceremonies you can do at the temple. And so what they ended up doing, they came up with this ingenious system where they divided each task into tiny little parts. Like for the evening prayers, there's this sacrifice that needs to be offered, and someone needs to get the wood for the sacrifice, and someone needs to burn the wood, and then they need to do the sacrifice, and then someone needs to sweep up the ashes, and then someone needs to say the evening prayer. And they would divide it up into all these parts. And then they would practice sortilege. Sortilege is the practice of drawing lots.
Oh,
to find out what God's will is.
Oh, I'm sweeping up again. I can't believe it.
And so they would have this team of priests. So originally, yeah, you know, like in Moses's time, or this would have all been done by one guy, but now there are 8,000 priests. And so they divide up the jobs into all these little parts, and then they draw lots to see who God wills to do which task this time. And we also see that in the Gospel of Luke, because we're told that this time the lot had fallen to Zechariah to burn the incense. And then we know that the person who burned the incense was also, after burning the incense in private, was supposed to come out and bless the people. And that's why in Luke's gospel, all the people are waiting for Zechariah to come out. And when he can't, he's been struck dumb and he can't give the blessing.
That's
the background to all that. We know all this from Jewish writings in the Talmud, in the Mishnah.
Yeah.
But you also, because you had all these priests who only did this, I mean, if you're like Zechariah, this may be the only time in your career it's your turn to offer the incense.
Oh.
You know, so, I mean, there are all these other jobs, and so this may be the only time in your career you ever do this task. You've never done this before. You may never do this again. You need a professional priest coach. And so they had priests who worked at the temple on a regular basis, who knew the details of the job, and their function was to coach the other priests through the ceremonies.
Okay.
And you'd also have priests who were like, it seems kind of funny, but they're like there to direct the crowds tell people tell all the pilgrims where to go, mm-hmm, and stuff like that. So it was a really intricate system they had set up there at the temple.
Holly, thank you for that question. We're talking about life in the time of Jesus. Kind of related to that, Jimmy, if you talk about Judaism, and clearly where Jesus lived, there would have been Judaism and synagogues and the temple and all that. Mm-hmm. But what were the religions of that time? Like, what would have been the you know, today I it wouldn't shock me at all to walk down a street and there's a Methodist church, and over here there's a, mm-hmm. a Buddhist temple, and over there there's a synagogue. What would you have seen in Jesus'
yeah.
day?
Well, there were so kind of the question blends a couple of different things.
Okay,
because like if you mentioned a synagogue, that's a fundamentally different religion. Because it's Jewish rather than Christian. But
yeah.
if you say a Methodist church, that's like a particular type of Christian.
Yes.
And so if we look at the kind of broader question first, what religions in the big sense did they have? Well, Judaism was obviously one of them. Also, you could, and this one is kind of on the border, you could count Samaritanism.
Oh,
differently, okay. but you also
kind of
could
Judaism.
Not because they're really worshiping the same God. They yeah. themselves are part Jewish, and it's just a dispute about where should the temple be? Should it be on Mount Zion or should it be on Mount Gerizim?
Yeah,
and so really, it's more accurate to see Samaritanism as a variety of Judaism.
Yeah,
and you will even find some books written today that talk about Samaritan Jews. But you also found people who were of other religions in the area. You know, in Matthew 16, when Jesus declares Peter the rock, it's mentioned in the Gospels that this happens at a place called Caesarea Philippi.
Yes.
And that's an inland community that's up in the north of Israel. And one of the things it's known for is it has this big cliff there, and many Bible scholars have seen this cliff as kind of the symbolic backdrop to Jesus saying, "You are Peter, you are rock," because
mm-hmm.
they've got this massive rock there.
Yeah.
But what a lot of people don't know is at the base of this cliff face, and I've been there, by the way. In fact, I have a chunk of the cliff face. One thing they don't mind you exporting from Israel is rocks.
Really?
They've got plenty
Go
of
ahead
them.
And take a
I
rock.
Even showed it to the tourist authority or to the authorities on the way out, and they said, yeah, take it. So I have this big, it's about 15-pound chunk of that cliff face in my office. But at the base of the cliff is a cave and a spring and the ruins of a shrine. And that location is called Banyas. Now, the reason it's called Banyas is that's the Arabic name for it. But in Arabic, they don't have the sound for the letter P. They don't have the P sound.
Oh.
And so what Arabic speakers will commonly do when they're importing a word that has the P sound from another language is they'll substitute the sound for the letter B, B.
Okay.
So, for example, when Arabic speakers are learning English for the first time, they would have trouble saying please, and so they'll say bleez, at least as a temporary measure until they can learn the P sound.
Right.
Well, so Banyas is a borrowing from Greek, which does have the P sound. So you would suppose that the original Greek name for the place was?
Panias,
right, after the god Pan.
Oh, so right there.
So you had a shrine to the god Pan there.
Yeah.
And you had other shrines to pagan gods as well. You know, we have like Jesus going to the Decapolis.
Right.
And so forth, the 10 cities.
Right.
Well, they weren't Jews. And you had various cities even within the territory of like Galilee, for example, and elsewhere in the region that were Gentile and that were pagan. Some of them worshipped Greco-Roman gods. Some of them worshipped Middle Eastern gods. Herod, wanting to keep peace with everybody, not only did things like build the temple for the Jews,
yeah.
he also helped pagan communities build their cities. And so it was a religiously mixed community. Jews were the dominant religion.
Okay.
But there was a substantial Gentile present there that were worshiping other deities.
The Life in the Time of Jesus, our topic this hour, Jimmy Akin, our guest. Jimmy has a brand new And he's the first one to do one of these. He's got a brand new course in the brand new School of Apologetics. The School of Apologetics has been a dream around here, a goal, an ambition for a very long time. And it's getting off the ground now. The first course is called, well, Beginning Apologetics. It covers all kinds of stuff from methods to defending the faith, history of apologetics, existence of God, the case for the Christian faith, evidence for the Catholic Church, the reliability of the New Testament, objections to the church, and practical techniques you need to know as an apologist. It's roughly 7 hours of instruction and includes a downloadable study guide. You can join Jimmy for the first course in the new School of Apologetics, Beginning Apologetics, and you can get $30 off right now. Just go to shop.catholic.com and sign up today. shop.catholic.com.
Call and ask Jimmy your question today on Catholic Answers Live.
A lot of people think that street evangelization involves yelling out of a bullhorn telling people that they're going to hell. Not so with St. Paul's Street Evangelization. Our methods are non-confrontational and effective. We simply offer information on the Catholic faith, along with rosaries, miraculous medals, and prayer. Pope Francis wrote about how beautiful it is to see street preachers joyfully bringing Jesus to every corner of the earth. Street evangelization is fun and fruitful. Join us today at streetevangelization.com.
Dr. Doctor, featuring Drs. Tom McGovern, Chris Stroud, and Andrew Mullally.
The number of people who are on government assistance expanded so much. Personally, I had patients in my office in tears saying, you know, I never thought of myself as somebody on government assistance. I just bought a new car. I can afford a brand new car, but I'm still on Medicaid.
Dr. Doctor, Saturdays at 11 a.m. Eastern on EWTN Radio.
Called twice with a question for this hour, and I did a bad job of getting him on the air, and I apologize, Alan, but he did leave us with his question. He's listening up in Oregon on Modern Day Radio. Was Jesus a carpenter or a stonemason, and was he pretty strong?
Well, he would have been pretty strong by ancient standards, certainly, because of the physical work that both of those jobs involved, whether you're a carpenter or a woodworker or a stonemason. This is a question that often comes up. The word that's used to describe Joseph and Jesus in the New Testament is tekton. It's a Greek word, and I've looked it up in one of the major Greek dictionaries, and it appears that it could be used both ways. It could be used both to refer to woodworkers, you know, people who worked with wood in one form or another. It also could be used for stonemasons. And so the word itself doesn't seem to tell us.
Okay.
And the Gospels don't seem to tell us. But something else might. In the middle of the, and obviously a person can work in both materials. You know, he could be trained to work in both.
Right.
But in the middle of the second century, there was a gentleman from Nablus. You've probably heard of Nablus in the West Bank.
Yes, right. Yeah. But Nablus is how they pronounce it now, right? Or do they
well,
say how?
It depends on where
maybe
you're
I'm
from.
Maybe I'm just thinking of American news reports.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
And so back then, Nablus was called Neapolis.
Oh.
Or the new city.
Yeah.
It was Latin for the new city. And there was a gentleman from Neapolis named Justin who got martyred. And so he's known to us as Justin Martyr. And in Justin Martyr's writings, he was a mid-second century apologist. In his dialogue with Trypho the Jew, he mentions that Joseph, and I think he says this is true of Jesus as well, made like plows and yokes for individuals. I part of my memory also says he may have mentioned chairs, but he also mentioned some of these are still around, and I think he may even say that some of the ones Jesus made are still around. But that would seem to, and this is only, you know, 120 years,
yeah.
And furniture, especially if it was made by God's foster father or God.
Yeah, he's good. You know, he's really good.
Well, I was going to say people are going to kind of protect it,
yeah,
you know,
right,
and hold care
on to
for
that.
It. Valuable antique.
That's not going up on Craigslist.
No, yeah. And so, it's quite possible that some of these well-made craftsmanship items could have survived to Justin Martyr's, at least his lifetime, mm-hmm. you know, because he's writing in the mid-second century, say 150.
Yeah.
But he would have been born earlier than that and could have seen these things earlier in life. So it's quite possible that some of the materials, some of the items that Joseph and Jesus made could have survived into the second century and people would have still said, oh yeah, this is, you know who made this?
Yeah.
That would seem to indicate that Joseph and Jesus at least worked in wood. They also may have worked in other materials.
All right. Thank you very, very much for that, Alan. Let's go to Teresa in Philadelphia, listening on Holy Spirit Radio. Teresa, what question have you got for Jimmy Akin?
Actually, it has to do with the last question you just answered.
Oh.
It's about Jesus. It doesn't really say much about what he did from the time he was maybe 12 to 30 and the New Testament. So some people say that he traveled and brought the word to faraway countries. And I was just wondering about that because it really doesn't say much about what he did.
Yeah. So there have been legends that Jesus traveled to other lands in his so-called hidden years between 12 and 30. You'll even find people claiming he went to India and Tibet. And a few years ago, there was a number of books published by New Age authors who had claimed that there he learned the secret teachings of the lamas and the Vedics and stuff.
Oh,
and
yeah.
Christianity is in some way based on Hinduism and Buddhism. Serious scholars do not regard this as at all credible.
Yeah.
And the overwhelming likelihood, given that Jesus was from a poor family. I mean, you read the Gospel of Luke's infancy narrative, and when they offer the sacrifice after Jesus's birth at the temple for Mary's purification, it's the cheapest one that's there for poor people to give. So they were a poor family. They did receive, you know, some gifts from the Magi a couple of years later that presumably they used on their trip to Egypt, but it wasn't enough to bankroll them for life and set them up in style.
I see.
Jesus, we know, depended on the generosity of others to conduct his ministry. So he and his family didn't have money in any substantial qualities, and they would not have been international travelers. The overwhelming likelihood is that they stayed right there in Palestine, spent most of their time in Galilee, in and around Nazareth, although they may have occasionally gone to the family home in Bethlehem where they had relatives. And Joseph worked as a manual laborer. You know, you're working a manual laborer, you can't really, you've got a client base you need to work with. And Jesus would have presumably either worked directly with Joseph or, I don't know, maybe been apprenticed to somebody else. He also would have spent time studying. He obviously, and this was unusual for the day, but he could read. And we know that because he reads from a scroll of Isaiah in the Gospels out loud at a synagogue. So he obviously was trained to read and write. So he had some schooling. He would have been tutored. He also would have been apprenticed either to his father or to someone else to learn his trade.
Teresa, thank you very, very much for that question. I've often thought too that if he was like a world traveler, the reaction of his own family to of being totally startled by his ministry when he starts on that is wouldn't be quite consistent with that.
Yeah.
They would have thought, oh, he's always doing these weird
thing
things.
Again. Yeah. Yeah.
Eve in Illinois, listening on Covenant Network. You are up next, Eve. Your question for Jimmy.
Yes. Hello. My question is, where did the Holy Family live at that time?
Well, we know that they lived initially. I mean, Joseph and Mary were both from Nazareth. And if you go to Nazareth today and you look at the Basilica of the Annunciation, it's built over an extremely early Christian church. Nazareth, incidentally, is a community that's kind of built into the side of a hill. You know how at one point they're going to throw, Jesus is at Nazareth, they're going to throw him off of a cliff?
Oh, yeah.
That's because it's built on the side of a hill. And a lot of the people there lived in caves. Their homes were built into cave structures. And they would, you know, modify the caves. They weren't like, you know, the stereotypical image of cavemen living in an unmodified cave.
Right.
But they would modify them. So they would like build cisterns to hold water mm-hmm. and mikvahs, which were the ceremonial baths. That they would use for purification rituals. And you can go there today and go into the homes, the archaeological excavations of the first century homes in Nazareth. And the Basilica of the Annunciation is built over one that is built over an ancient Christian church that is regarded as a good candidate for the one that the Holy Family lived in, because it was converted to a Christian church very early. And so it's the one that's traditionally regarded as this is the one where they lived. In terms of when Jesus was born, now as Matthew records and as Luke records, they were in Bethlehem. Matthew particularly, I should say, focuses on this, but also Luke. And that is a suburb sort of Jerusalem. So it's farther south, it's up in the mountains. And at the time, they were there when Jesus was born, but they apparently stayed there for a while, or at least came back, because up to 2 years later, which is when the Magi arrive, they're living in a house in Bethlehem. And this also traditionally is, and this also, I believe Justin Martyr is one who mentions this in the second century. This is also traditionally regarded as having been a cave house. At least part of the dwelling was built into a cave. And that's why when you go to the Basilica of the Nativity in Bethlehem today, you go down and it's built on top of a cave that was used as an early Christian church. And so so you can see all of that, but that's the information we have about where Jesus's family lived. We know of these two locations, one in Nazareth, one in Bethlehem, and we even have plausible sites in both of those locations for the specific dwellings, because they were quickly apparently converted to churches, or at least these are very early Christian churches there. The only other place we know they lived was Egypt, and it's not clear where in Egypt they would have lived. It was probably in the Nile Delta, which is the northern part of Egypt where the Nile forks as it comes up to the Mediterranean Ocean. It's the easiest part of Egypt to live in. The rest of it's a desert.
Mm-hmm.
But the Nile Delta is the wettest part of Egypt. It's the easiest to live in, therefore. And although we can't say for sure, because there were other Jewish communities like Elephantine, where they actually had a temple to God. There was a major Jewish colony in Alexandria, which is a city founded by Alexander the Great, and it was the seat of government at the time, and a major trading port right there on the Mediterranean Ocean. I've actually been there. Some of the natives call it Skandar today. They'll say, I'm going to Skandar, Alexandria.
Oh, Skandar.
Yeah. And there's a good chance. I mean, if that would be the single most likely place for the Holy Family to have gone, because there would have been other Jews there. They could have found family connections and so forth. On the other hand, they could have gone elsewhere, but that would be the single most likely place.
If I may, Jimmy, just add to Eve's question.
Mm-hmm.
So when you think about a place like Nazareth where Jesus grew up, mm-hmm. primarily, how big a place are you talking about?
It was tiny in the first century, a few dozen people.
And a few dozen people.
Yeah.
So it's really just barely a village.
Yeah.
So, and would they have been like, okay, so I got a few dozen people here. Where do I got to go to, you know, the closest market or the—
Oh, there were other towns nearby.
Okay.
Like Sepphoris was one of the bigger towns nearby.
Uh-huh.
But there were little villages all over the place. And local knowledge was important. That's why, and I talk about this in one of my DVDs on Are the Gospels Reliable? When they're at the the Sea of Galilee and Jesus is doing the feeding of the 5,000, he mentions that they're at this particular location, which, and it's mentioned in another gospel, Philip is from that location there at Bethsaida.
Yeah.
And Jesus therefore asks Philip, where can we go to get food for these people?
Oh, yeah,
because he's the local, he would know.
You know where the country store is, Philip.
Yeah.
Where do we get food for these people? Jimmy Akin, thank you very, very much.
My pleasure.
I love these history shows we do.
Yeah.
I don't know if anybody else. Yeah, I know other people do because they call, but I want to do more of them. Jimmy Akin's latest book, The Bible is a Catholic Book. You can get it at shop.catholic.com right now. And equally important, well, something that we're really celebrating around here is the new School of Apologetics. Head over to shop.catholic.com and take Jimmy's brand new beginning apologetics course. More courses to follow until the school is full of these courses in apologetics. Tomorrow, 2 hours of open forum. We'll see you then, God willing, on Catholic Answers Live.